over these last 5, 6, 7 years now. I started Tiny Hemp Homes back in like 18, and you know, we were doing good, working on several projects around the state. I built a couple, well, 4 or 5 now of my own projects. Everything was going great, and then bam, COVID hit. And so stopped the hempcrete classes, you know, then had a fire in the Santa Cruz Mountains. I had to move out, lost everything there.
Hey guys, it's Mandy with Global Hemp Association. I wanted to say thank you so much for joining. I'm excited about the opportunity to build a relationship and connect this supply chain. I mean, after all, that's why we started the association. Our association was built on the foundation of connecting supply chain, building relationships, and helping you grow your business. Anyone from farmers, manufacturers, and distributors, people that are passionate about the supply chain, and those creating products selling into biofuels, plastics, textiles, construction, and building materials.
Hey, Wade, thank you so much for joining me today.
What a great pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. And thank you, everybody else, for joining and chiming in. Please let us know where you're listening in from. Ask any questions. Yesterday, we really focused on textile and non-wovens. And today, I'm really excited to dive into some of the construction opportunities and the whys and the do's and the don'ts and how things are going over in California with Wade and his team. But before I get started, I want to give a quick shout out to all of our corporate sponsors and corporate members for the association. Without you guys, we couldn't be doing what we're doing. I received fabulous feedback yesterday about one of our interviews and the connections that are being made. And so I just want to say thank you to all of everything that you guys have done. Quick shout out to who some of our corporate members are: Eli Environmental Living Industries in Texas, a First Citizens Bank just joined as a corporate member. And so thank you very much for all of your support. Global Fiber, Renaissance, IND Hemp, and Hemp Blockchain. I had to write them down because our list is getting a little bit longer. So just to name a few, I want to say thank you very much for everything that you guys are doing, and thanks for your support. If anybody has questions about the association, some of the projects we're doing, our hemp fiber variety trials, don't hesitate to reach out. And we look forward to seeing you guys at NOCO this year. We're going to be presenting on some of our trial data and sharing some of the results. So across 10 different states, 10 different varieties, we received or were able to collect some great data and really look at, you know, what genetics are working across multiple regions and what yield looks like for farmers and weather patterns and things like that. So I'm excited to see everybody. Please connect. But before I keep going and keep talking about everything we're doing, Wade, the whole purpose of this is to hear what you're up to. So before we get started, you want to introduce yourself and tell everybody kind of what you did before getting into the industrial hemp space?
Sure. So my name is Wade Atterbury. I was born and raised in Southern California till I was about 9, and then transplanted to New England, New Hampshire, and started swinging a hammer when I was probably 15 years old as the industry was absolutely booming. I've never really seen it ever boom like that. I know there's been regions that have been good, but I made a great living my whole life. You know, started my first company when I was 18, had 36 people working for me, hanging, you know, doing sheetrock, grossed $1 million a year when I was 18. I was diagnosed with terminal cancer when I was 19, lost everything, started over again when I was 20, fired my company right back up. We were still in the middle of the boom, 36 people working again, doing sheetrock. I quit my radiation treatment, so got terminal cancer back again, real bad the second time. I did chemo for almost a year. Yeah, it was rough. You know, 21 years old, you're in your prime. It's like, I don't need chemotherapy. I'm good. But so that was a really rough start. And then, you know, was able to get back right to it again when I was 22 and caught the last year of the boom, which was great. And then, you know, it's been that boom bust cycle ever since. You know, I wish somebody explained that to us in school. I wish there were business classes in, you know, 8th and 9th grade. That would have been nice. So construction's been my forte. I used to, more recently, 10, 15 years ago, almost 20 years ago now, owned a big showroom in San Jose, a kitchen and bath showroom, doing remodels. I was in the asbestos remediation industry, commercial, big, huge projects, ran projects with, you know, 300 people. So my forte has been in the construction industry, building houses from the ground up, and mainly remodels. So I see what makes a house not last. And, you know, it's fire, it's water damage, which creates rot. which, you know, any water brings in insects and bugs. So especially in the deep south, you see a lot of rotted houses. You know, in fire zones, we see houses just burning to a crisp and there's nothing left. What's even worse is when you live in a brand new house or a recently built house that's wrapped in plastic. And if you don't have 100% of the outside of your house sealed with caulkings and everything, one little leak, and now you have a petri dish in your wall and you're breathing all that black mold in the air in your house. So that's just been something I've really been following over the last couple of decades, is the unhealthy home syndrome and the way we build. And I, you know, I'm guilty. That's the way I was taught. I didn't know any better. And over these last 5, 6, 7 years now, I started tiny hemp homes back in like 18. And, you know, we were doing good, working on several projects around the state. I built a couple, well, 4 or 5 now of my own projects. Everything was going great. And then, bam, COVID hit. And so stopped the hempcrete classes, you know, then had a fire in the Santa Cruz Mountains. I had to move out, lost everything there. Then, you know, massive heart attack. I was just telling you about that a little while ago. So that's it's been kneecapped a few times recently. Western Fiber, I was introduced to them almost 2 years ago now. They had converted this cotton gin here in Riverdale over to run hemp. And I was really intrigued, excuse me, because I really was into the herd side. And if they're doing fiber, I'm like, hey, great. This is what we've all been talking about. You got the fiber, the waste of the herd is, you know, is the cheap part for us to do the building. Well, I got in here, realized that there are no fiber customers. Nobody's buying fiber. It's really difficult to make a product on mass production scale if you have nobody buying it. You know, we could ship bales to China, but it's just, it's not worth it. So we pivoted here at the Riverdale Hemp Gin with Western Fibers and decided to go ahead and start building tiny hemp homes. So we developed a system, you know, true hempcrete wall. We want that lime plaster on the outside and on the inside. And then we want hempcrete in the middle. So the big thing about that is really, we don't want plywood sheathing. We don't want a vapor barrier. We don't want Tyvek. We don't want siding. We don't want sheetrock. We don't want trim. We don't want paint. We don't want caulking. We don't want any of those things in our walls. So we developed a double stud wall here, but we use what's called a truss or a web. You know how roof trusses have the webs in them? Mm-hmm. So we developed web walls. Well, in order to build a web wall, you need a truss plant. You have to build it on truss machinery. I couldn't get a company to even make me a test wall. Nobody was interested. Nobody's interested in saving the planet when they're making money. So, and that's really a realization I've come to lately, which is sad. So I found a truss plant that was actually for sale. And unfortunately they wanted, you know, $500,000 for it. But we didn't need the trucks. So we ended up working out in a deal, and Tom and Mike backed the deal and said, yeah, let's make it happen. So we bought the company. Moved all the equipment here to the big barn. So now the barn is a factory to build tiny homes in. You saw that barn. It's 460 feet long by 160 feet wide, 65 feet tall. So it's a, we have a huge undercover, you know, under roof area to build in. And that's just, it's perfect for us. We bought 33 building lots, 18 miles away in a little town called Huron. And these are in a modular home park. It's stubbed up with water and power and sewer. So we have our first phase, a place to build our homes and set them on. Unfortunately, when we bought the land, we all very small note on that now. We put all the money into it. That was basically the end of the capital from the partners to be able to put in. So now we're kind of, you know, we've built the foundation. We have everything. We need some cash flow to move forward and take that next step. You know, get some engineering done, get some blueprints drawn up, build our first true model home. We've built plenty of proof of concepts, prototype stuff. So we're ready. I mean, we're chomping at the bit, ready to go.
Okay, so I've got all kinds of questions, but I want to back up to, you know, why hemp as the building material? You know, you talked also about eliminating all of these materials to continue that are really right now being used to build one wall. Where are we at as far as a time frame to be able to beat price by saving on all of that material and making a more cost-effective home initially, as well as long-term due to savings, insulation, term of the home, so forth?
So ROI, you know, return on investment. Mm-hmm. If you're just talking about a financial ROI, we do have that, but really it's the ROI for the next generation. It's the ROI for the planet that really concerns me. If we don't start building carbon negative homes, if we don't start making carbon negative products, there is no future. We don't have, our the next generation isn't going to have anywhere near the lifestyle we had anyway. They're going to be busy cleaning up our crap.
Energy. We look at energy efficiency, right? That it's multiple countries, not just the United States, are in major crisis for energy.
Absolutely. Look at Texas. I mean, you know, they have these freeze spells and their grid just goes down. It's, you know, it's not fair to the people.
Yeah.
And Texas is really huge now in renewables. You know, don't listen to the news. It's, they really are coming on fast with renewables. It's their grid that's the issue. But when you're talking solar farms, like where I live here in the San Joaquin Valley, I am positive we, and I don't know the exact facts, but I'm sure that we create way more power with all these solar farms around here than we use here. I'm sure this goes back into the grid probably 30-40% more than what, you know, any of us use here. So really? And that has to keep happening. And a spider grid is the best way, because like, yeah, I've been here at the gym 2 years. I don't think power's gone out like once, maybe for 15 minutes. That's it. So, because we're on a spider grid and we have, there's really literally solar farms in every direction all the way around me. So they feed back into the grid. But building with hempcrete sequesters CO2 out of the atmosphere. I mean, I know everybody pretty much, if you're interested in this, you probably know this, but mm-hmm. I actually just found a great study out of Australia and it talks about, you know, tonnage and how much CO2 is pulled out. And, you know, it's always been kind of a myth to me. I've heard all the
Uh-oh, Wade. You know, I know you're on your cell phone.
I got a quick call, so I turned it off.
That's okay.
So basically with the hempcrete, it sequesters CO2 out of the atmosphere. We can pull about 2.5 tons of CO2 out of the atmosphere for every 1 ton of dried hemp material. So you saw our crop the year we grew 25 foot tall plants. So those were the Hunnei, the Chinese landrace strain, does extremely well here in the Central Valley. So if you could pull 2.5 tons of CO2 out of the atmosphere in just 1 ton of dried hemp, how does that work? Well, 20% of the CO2 is actually locked up in the soil, in the root system, and it stays there, and that's great. The rest of it is a conversion into carbon, which has a different weight, you know, compared to the stalk. But when you look at a stalk, like the hemicellulose, the cellulose, and the lignin is what basically makes up the stalk of a hemp plant. Mm-hmm. And that's roughly about 40-45% carbon. So we've now converted CO2 that we pulled out of the atmosphere into carbon. So CO2, carbon, we've locked that up. The O2 is oxygen that we've now put back into the atmosphere as clean air for us to breathe. So the more hemp we grow, the cleaner the atmosphere. When we build a home, our homes are carbon negative. We put so much hemp into them that even after adding up all of the copper, all of the glass, all of the metal roof, everything that's added into that, we're still below zero with our homes, even on the piece of property ready for somebody to move into. So one of my pet peeves is people think they're all, oh, we're net zero. I mean, net zero is BS to me. It doesn't matter if you're net zero. Net zero is the amount of energy you're going to use to heat and cool that home. If you built that home and used foam insulation and off-gassing formaldehydes and just, you know, put a 20 gigatons of CO2 into the atmosphere to build that home to be net zero so you can pat yourself on the back, you're an idiot. It's just, we can't keep going like that. There is no future like that. We have to build carbon negative. And when I say build carbon negative, that's plant-based building materials. Plant-based building materials is what we did before World War II. That was called Chemergy. Chemergy went away after World War II. DuPont killed it. Harry Anslinger, the whole, you know, the newspaper conglomerates, all they killed Chemergy. When we made everything out of plant bases, it was either metal, glass, or plant. That's all we had for technology.
I think that's that plastic.
So we have to change. we don't have a choice anymore. We have to get back to making all materials out of plant-based. There's as much as we can. I mean, we know we can't do metal, we can't do glass, we get that.
So I have a question really quick. This is, and just kind of a, I'm a little bit confused or a little bit unsure about how much carbon is being sequestered from hemp, right? Because there are so many factors from soil, how it's harvested, you know, what happens to the fiber or the plant afterwards, if it's locked up long term. There are a lot of obviously questions, or I think how it's monitored and how it's validated. But I think that what you're pointing on, or what we're pointing to, is we have this opportunity to lock this biomass or carbon up long term in a building that we really haven't done before. Right now, if I'm taking hemp fiber and turning it into a textile t-shirt, we're not doing that necessarily. But in a home where you're locking up the biomass, it becomes pretty powerful. So I have a question, obviously, and we talk about expanding, and I think tiny homes are different than, say, a low income, you know, multi-unit build. But what about labor and benefit to offsite manufacturing compared to on-site building? Can you, because really this is where I think we have big opportunity. And what I hear from other manufacturers and large organizations or companies within the offsite building or manufacturing space saying, hey, we need a wall built to a custom size. And here we've got a new material that we can do that. Now it's just a shoe in to their existing supply chain. Can you speak to that some more?
Absolutely. So basically, building with hempcrete, obviously, we know it has to happen. When you do what's called on-site construction, where you're actually framing a house at the site, which to me now, I mean, that's what I did my whole life. To me now, it's like I want to throw up when I think about it. It's horrible. When you look at Europe, for 20 years, they've been building their stuff in factories. They're more than 50% now. Most European countries build all of their residential or commercial structures in a factory, bring them to the site. There's so many benefits to building in a factory. I'll rip off a few. One is the amount of waste. You'll reduce the amount of waste by 95% on average. Autoval up in Idaho, they're very robotic. The front end, when I say the front end, that's the framing, the sheathing, the sheetrock, you know, the spraying of the foam insulation. Horrible, but those are all done by robots in these factories now. So for us, the same thing. We utilize a truss manufacturing process where we build our floor trusses, our roof trusses, and our walls now out of the trusses. And then we interlock them all together. We don't use nails. We use truss plates, superior to nails by, I mean, I don't know what the number is. I want to say they're probably 100 times stronger. There's no way when you put a truss plate on each side of a couple of pieces of wood, you can't bend that with your hand. There's no way you're going to break that with your hands. You know, there's nails, of course, you fold it right over, nothing. So again, that's one of the beauties of the truss. And I didn't even really realize that when I came up with the design, when, you know, we here at Western Fibers came up with that design. Using a truss plant was now all of a sudden, oh my God, it's so much faster. Not only is it faster, it's repeatable perfectly time and time again, because when you build a wall or a roof truss, you build it on what's called a build deck. You have 2x4s down set up in a template. You just take a piece of wood, set it where it fits. So a 5-year-old kid can work in our factory and build walls. If you can put a square block in a square hole and a round block in a round hole, you can build walls here at the factory because it's in a template and it's repeatable every single time. And those truss plates get put on, it gets put through the press. We take a crane, we stand the walls up so nobody has to lift a heavy wall anymore. And then we just start building. And that's where the hand labor really comes in. You know, we have to spray our, so we've developed a spray machine. Western Fibers has been in the spray insulation industry, the technology side, for 45 years. You know, Mike McGuire, CEO of Western Fibers, has probably made and built more, hemp cellulose or cellulose spray machines than anybody on the planet. The knowledge he has in his little finger when it comes to, you know, cellulose insulation is what most people, you know, would take a lifetime to understand. So I'm so fortunate to be a part of the team here, you know, like Tom running the gin. He's run this gin for 45 years. He knows every nut and bolt. He's replaced every nut and bolt in the thing. He totally understands how to comb fiber. And that's what it takes you know, to convert machinery over. People say, oh, well, you know, there's all this brand new machinery. You don't need to spend a million or 20 million or 60 million on a setup, you know, a decorticación machine and a fiber combing machine until the industry's ready for it. Let's take these cotton gins. Let's take this first step. Let's reuse what we already have. There's, you know, used to be 300 cotton gins in California. There's like 20 left, you know, probably 20 more sitting fallow that could be bought for, you know, less than $1 million each. And now you have a massive facility to be able to process hemp, and it works extremely well. I mean, even since you've seen it, we've gotten better. Like right now, our herd is absolutely no dust, no fiber, perfect particle size every single time. And I think I heard you comment when you were in the gym, you were amazed at how little dust was floating around. Mm-hmm. And it was actually, that was kind of a dusty day, which was kind of weird because I'm thinking, oh man, this is horrible. We got dust in the air. Normally we don't. So the cyclones, because of the gin, we have extra cyclones that you wouldn't normally have in like an Ag 660 machine or you know, one of these other decorticator companies that are building these things. So we've already been through this for 40 years. They understand dust. You know,
go ahead. I have a question for those that may understand the cotton ginning process, right? How, because part of the machine was converted and other parts could still potentially be used for running cotton, which I see as a huge value add because that gin sits unused for so many months, or it's only used for so many months during cotton season, right? When you're running. So then what part of it is actually new or changed? You know what I mean? Is it
starts the comber? So there's a couple different types of cotton. So upland cotton was the cotton that's traditionally been grown. And then they came out with this new cotton. It's a Pima. It's a finer cotton. So most people grow Pima. So if, I don't know if you saw in the gin that we have two sections of the gin. We have the old side and the new side. So the new side is for Pima. But again, we don't grow enough. That hasn't been run in 4 years because the co-op here owns two gins. So the other gin's 8 miles away. So that's the gin they run 2 to 3 months a year. So we converted over the saw gin. And that's everything that's changed is it basically comes down to rotation speed, speed of pushing and pulling stuff through the pipes, how tight the tolerances are, the sizing of the rip saws, the little tiny fingers inside there. And, you know, that's where Tom just understands this stuff. He just, he doesn't sleep at night. I guarantee it. He just keeps working it through his mind.
He's incredibly smart. Your team, yeah. Tom is so knowledgeable and so willing to say, hey guys, let's do this. Let's use, like you said, the equipment that we already have and take advantage of the opportunity, right? Another thing that I really noticed, Wade, is the size. Talk to me a little bit about your crop that you guys have grown. You guys, the stalks were huge running through this machine and the fiber was very clean that was coming out the other side. Right. There are, and of course there are multiple steps in between, but when we see a lot of these big stocks, right, there's this concern for the size of fiber or quality of fiber. Can you kind of talk about methodology, what plans are for, you know, harvesting and planting next year, and maybe even touch on what happened to your crop this year?
You got it. So the Hyundai, and we've grown with Tony DeVera helping and even, you know, in the 3 or 4 years ago now, we had Larry Serban, you know, involved with our first big crop there, our test crop, not big crop, but test crop. What I've witnessed is when you grow a hemp field of the Hyundai and you let it go for, you know, 120, 140 days, it'll get 20, 25 feet tall. Now, the inside of the field, 10 feet in, is all still very small, 5/8, 7/8 of an inch from the ground all the way to the top. What you saw was probably some of the outside, what I call soldier plants. And those grow big, fat, thick stalks because that's where the wind is hitting. So they are bending all the time. And when you bend a hemp plant, that's how it gets stronger. So, you know, I come from the cannabis industry. We have to have fans in rooms because otherwise the plants would just grow up, they would bud out and then fall over. So the more wind you have when they're small and growing, the stronger those fibers get. They rip and break. It's just like your muscles when you work out. You tear a muscle, it builds back better. So it's the same thing. So those outside of the hemp crop is the big stuff, and it actually grows up and then lays down into like a ramp. So the wind comes up and goes over the field. So it's really incredible how hemp almost becomes its own society when it grows. And I know you've been at hemp fields, so you're probably going to understand how this is. So we had an entomologist come and do an insect survey, little yellow cards, all around the outside, 25 feet in, 25 feet in, 25 feet in. So when we got our report back, the lady that did it, she brought her a supervisor in. I'm blanking on the college that did that, but they were blown away because the crop was super healthy. I believe it was.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, UC Davis, you guys did some stuff with.
So the whole crop was healthy. The beneficials were thriving in the center. On the very outside, with 25 feet in, we had all of our unfriendly pests. We had, we had spider mites. We had, bad bugs that eat plants that, aren't healthy for the plants. But those plants were healthy because the predator mites that were 25 to 50 feet in was that next layer. And then all the beneficials were 50 feet and then in towards the center. So it was like its own community. The beneficials were keeping the bad bugs at bay on the outside. They could only survive on the outside, but they could never thrive and take over. The beneficials just kept eating them. The more they grew, the more the beneficials were eating them. So it's a totally symbiotic relationship with the insect population. I was there. I can't even tell you how many days I was literally covered from head to toe in bees. I've never been stung out here. 2 years of being out here working with hemp. And every time you're around hemp here, it's covered with bees. I mean, like nothing I've ever seen. And I've been in apple orchards, I've been in, cherry orchards, you name it, everything. I've never seen the attraction that bees have that they have to hemp. It just blows me away. It's a trip.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, and I have to say, when I was out there, I was just in awe. I have never seen so many orchards and so much agriculture. Everywhere we went, it was amazing. And so speaking to that also a little bit, and climate, right? You guys have long daylight, lots of daylight and long seasons for growing. Talk to me about upcoming year. What's your sowing density? What's your acreage you guys intend to put in? And what happened? Can you touch on why?
Yeah, I'll touch on that. So I'll back up one. So for us, we have we probably have 150 tons of hemp here at the facility now. So we can make 33 foot long bales in the module machine. So that's cotton industry. That's the way they do it.
They bale in the field.
Yes.
Yeah.
We bale it. We cut it, sickle bar it, let it ret. Scoop it up, windrow it, scoop it up, put it in a 33 foot long bale, 7 feet tall, 7 feet wide. We have a big, huge machine. It's called a module, and that goes out and we can fill that full of hemp. So we make 33 foot long bales, 7 feet tall. And those are perfect because we have what's called a walking deck ramp truck. So the big truck pulls up, it tilts and has big chains that roll. They'll pick that huge bale up. They'll come here to the gin. We can either set it out in the yard until we need it, or we can back it right up to the conveyor and run it right into the machinery, the shredder that we use. And that shredder breaks everything down to, 4 to 12 inches or so. So, and again, that's where a lot of the development came in, was trying to push this big stuff through that gin that's used to cotton. So, and Tom, this is his throttle. He just keeps going until it breaks. If it's running, he walks in.
Right? He understands the equipment.
He wants to break it.
Sure.
He just turns that knob up. Just keep turning it up until it breaks. Okay, let's go fix that. All right, you got it running again. Hey, let's turn it. Oh, it broke over here. All right, let's go fix that.
Yeah.
He's not satisfied until he breaks something. And then he tells the guys to fix it, and then he can leave.
Everybody needs a Tom on that.
Absolutely.
Team.
So we can use CBD and cannabis stalks for our hempcrete because we don't use, we don't need perfectly, dust-free, fiber-free herd. we chop the whole plant up. We can mix it with cotton stalks. We can mix it with recycled cardboard. We can mix it with recycled paper products. And then we spray our lime slurry at the end of the nozzle with that dry hemp coming out into the wall. So we actually pack in the wall. So there's no mixing in a mixer. You know, the Arise machine, I love it. I think it's a great machine. But we don't need all that infrastructure, the big, huge compressor, the, you know, large amount of power it takes to run that stuff. So we can literally do it. I mean, we're a 220 machine, but you can run it off a generator, and that's all you need. It's just air blowers and then a water pump for the slurry side of it. So our crop last year that we grew was doing really well. We were in our second year of biochar trials, and of course, we had our second generation Hanne seed that we had planted. And we were doing some more testing, some MS-77, and I think that was really the main one we had that we wanted to see how it did. And honestly, Mandy, MS-77 is Hanne. It's and maybe 10% less vigor than Hanne. So I think the
origin which those seeds come from is so important. Like our trials really showed that also.
I can't wait to see all your reports and figure this out, because that's super intrigued. Yeah. But so here in our county, we have to have permission from all of our land abutters, and a new person moved in and our license was expiring, so we had to get the new license. So they needed us to, any new land abutters had to sign off. Well, this guy, he told Tom flat out, you know, you guys are drug addicts. I don't want to expose my kids to these kind of drugs and you drug dealers and all this. And so he wouldn't sign off. And so Tom.
So the state required that your neighbors, the surrounding farms or landowners, sign off personally that you grow industrial hemp.
Yep. It's the same with radishes and corn. You know, if your neighbor doesn't sign off that you can grow, oh, no, wait a minute. No, yeah, you can grow anything else except for hemp.
I was going to say, wait, what? He's smart, Alec. But that, you're exactly right, right?
It's ridiculous. So it's beyond ridiculous.
The hand of a neighbor that may have wrong education or thought, or maybe at one time had a bad neighbor that was growing and it, hey, yeah, there's just,
it's, you're an idiot.
You had to plow your field under.
Yes. Right? The state told Tom that they would be there Friday with the sheriff. And, you know, my experience with police in my younger life means there's guys showing up with guns to ensure that you comply with the law.
Sure.
And so, you know, Tom didn't waste a second. He went out there and took it all down. And he didn't even tell me. I wanted to go out there and get video and pictures. I didn't know. He just went out there and, you know, it's that farmer mentality. It's, you know, it's red blooded. It's, you know, it's I don't want to say ego driven, but it's just that it's what it takes to be a farmer. You got to be tough. You got to be strong. You got to be able to, you know, overcome hurdles. And when you can't, it's super frustrating. And Tom is frustrated. I know with that, because I mean, shoot, we're probably 30 grand just into that, you know, 10 acre crop doing our testing and trials. I mean, Tom, and that doesn't even count the equipment. I mean, Tom went out and bought two big, huge John Deere seed drills, you know, more tractors. I mean, we have enough, we could farm 3,000 acres with the equipment we have now. So, but again, we have a ramp. We have ag waste in hemp stalks, in cotton stalks, in cannabis stalks that will fulfill what we need. Now, that doesn't make fiber, which is fine because obviously there's nobody to buy fiber. You know, that stuff will be great for non-wovens, you know, and we can comb that out in the gin, pull the herd. We can use the herd in our spray and then use that for non-wovens as soon as we can find a good, you know, non-woven buyer. And that's kind of what we're hoping with the MGO board.
Yeah, well, and I think that really changes with what you're feeding into, right? We talked yesterday to somebody who's in the non-woven space, but the micron size is still very small, and it's very textile focused on the crop production. You know, where if you're growing for herd production, you're probably going to harvest differently, ret differently, potentially, you know, and so it kind of depends. And it is, there's this huge opportunity in the industry right now for the material science side around that material, that fiber that's coming off of a larger stock or a potential cannabis stock that's flowered, because we know fiber quality changes as that develops.
And, you know, Mandy, honestly, I mean, I know you're pushing, you know, for the fiber and want to see that industry. Mm-hmm. I personally don't see that industry happening for another 10 years. Sure. Unless the government says, hey, we're going to put $1 trillion into this, or some big investor comes in and says, hey, I'll throw $100 billion. Let's get this thing going. But a spinning facility that makes thread and yarns, we know we've offshored all those. There are really none left here in America. Excuse me.
Yeah, it's definitely a small, very, very small, right? And like you said, what is that potential? Where I see big opportunity, Wade, and similar to the building industry, right, is the pain point is going to be that ban on plastics or that change, you know, the penalty that comes with the carbon footprint. And so I think it is coming. I do think it's going to be very costly for the U.S. to jump on to some of that. But we're seeing a lot of production in nonwovens and companies moving to, you know, natural fibers away from the plastics because of penalties.
Yeah, we have to. And that's the way it has to be done. And, you know, we have two political parties that are completely opposite in trying to figure that out right now. You know, we have one party doesn't even believe that, you know, climate is an issue. And then the other party that's saying, hey, man, you know, we need to stop burning fossil fuels. We're so far apart that one of my things is I've predicted that the next president, if it's not the next one, it'll be the one after, will be what I call a TikTok president. It's going to be somebody from social media who says, hey, man, you know, I've got 300 million followers. Vote for me. Let's take this country back. And you know, I just hope it's somebody who, you know, can do it. But that's how it's going to happen. It's going to be the under 25-year-olds are going to get out and vote, and they're going to vote for somebody that they want.
They're voting now. They're paying with their dollar, right? What do they care about and what's going to drive this? But yeah, so I still, you know, and I'm going to put this call out in a discussion we should be having within our industry is that pain point that we're solving for those manufacturers, right? Because I do see industry open up and I do see that there's opportunity coming. We just reality is we have a long way to go. We're new.
We need a moonshot money infusion from the government. We don't have a future without putting trillions of dollars into plant-based materials. And it's not just hemp. It's everything. We waste cotton stalks. When we harvest cotton, those cotton stalks get ground right back up into the soil and all that CO2 is released back into the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. Then we should go through, harvest the cotton, then go back, cut all the cotton stalks, bale that, and use that as all kinds of things. And insulation, it's cellulose fiber. It's not as good as hemp, in my opinion, for it. Maybe it is. I don't know. We have to do the testing to really see. But it's certainly a great blend. And that's the whole idea. Stop letting it go back into the atmosphere. We need to have plant-based materials turned into products. I went in front of Tremco CEOs. I mean, there were 12 CEOs in the room. It was a pitch, you know, deal. We made it to the top, I think 8 finalists. And so we got a pitch to their top people. I mean, these guys make $30 million a year salary. You know, Tremco's huge, you know, and they had their top 12 CEO people there. Like they own Rust-Oleum Paints, you know, they own huge companies. They're not interested in plant-based building products. Not at this time.
Well, I'll tell you, I talk to a lot of people about this that are on mm-hmm. the manufacturing side. And the question always comes back to what pain point do we solve for that part of the supply chain, right? It's like, why should they take on the risk, change their line to see if we'll have supply or to test whether or not we're going to get supply? I do want to make a real quick comment because there was something we said about not having any spinners in the U.S. And I agree, there are quite a few spinners on smaller scale in the Southeast and to make great yarn and commodity, right? Maybe not for commodity spinning, but for better yarn. There's a lot of players, Guy said. And so Guy is doing an incredible job. Right. For those of you that don't know, right, where he's at or what he's up to, be sure to look him up, Bear Fiber. Guy, I'm actually going to say I'm going to need some socks from you. So put that shout out there. But there is, I think that what we see also, right, is the difference in long spinning or wet spinning to compared to, and forgive me because this is not my expertise in the textile space, but the short staple fibers like the cotton. Yep. But our conversation yesterday with Bass Fiber Technologies talked a lot about that short fibers. You know, those short fibers are what they use. It's a matter of the micron, and it's non-woven into Q-tips or, you know, ear cotton swabs and feminine hygiene products and absorbents and, you know, the wipes. I every time I wipe and understand I'm, you know, flushing plastic down the toilet, or people are using it and flushing plastics down
the toilet.
You're
not supposed to put those down the toilet.
No, but you know what's happening, right? Yes, we mean that it's happening in our system. Yeah. And so, yeah, there's a lot, but.
I agree. That's so that, again, and only 1% of our clothing is made here in America. You know, this is a hemp shirt, but this wasn't made in America. You know, it's just like, come on, this is ridiculous, because we don't make enough thread and yarn to make the fabric for this next generation to be clothing designers and make their own products here in America. And that's really what has to happen. It's 99% market that's open. Let's get this younger generation to start making clothing. They would love that. It's an entry level step for them to get into industry.
Well, what about building? You know, I want to go back to building, because what you just said, right, is this idea of the American dream and home ownership is slipping out of our kids' hands. It is slipping away from them, right? What is needed, in your opinion, to really bridge this gap, and hemp being a tool to do that? You know, what do we need? And
as biased as I am, and you know, it sounds like I'm just doing an infomercial for ourselves, but really it's factory built homes. We absolutely have to get away from on-site building. On-site building is ridiculous. I like to say it's just like building a car in your driveway. You don't have somebody show up and start building your engine, and then somebody else shows up with a frame, and then we put it together. It'd be asinine to think that. We need to build them in factories. Do you know how long it takes to build a Tesla car in China right now? Like how long it takes for a car to come off the line?
I can't even imagine.
30 seconds.
Shanghai
Tesla plant, 30 seconds. Google it. Shanghai Tesla plant, every 30 seconds, a brand new Tesla rolls off the line. A car. We can't build a home in a factory every 30 seconds. Why not? Of course we can. We just have to have that kind of money and that kind of ingenuity to do it. And we're not far away. So that's the big thing. Like, just with this trust system, it makes everything go so much faster. And nobody in the modular industry is using the machinery that we are. So we're definitely going to be game changing in the industry. And then we have to prove it. You know, right now it's all theory. I mean, I know it's going to work. And everybody, of course, says that, you know, about your baby. But this is, with the team we have, I know that we can pump out, with probably 25 people on the factory floor, 250 homes a year. With just a few more people, I believe after 4 quarters of running this and figuring it out, that we can do 500 homes a year next year out of this facility, with maybe 30 people on the floor. So. And I apologize for Freedom flying over here. I'm right next to a large Air Force base, and they burn a lot of gas every day here, so it gets loud.
Somebody just left a comment with a whole bunch of jets and airplanes, and right as I did this last time, I heard them fly over, and I was like, this is perfect timing. Just ironic that this happened. So talk to me, if somebody's interested in getting involved, Wade, how do they, who fits inside that box of the perfect person you guys are looking to connect with, both on the gin side and with Western Fiber?
So that's what we're trying to figure out now, if we're going to kind of restructure. And, you know, I mean, what I would like to see, and this is me personally, you know, I'm a member of a team. I'm a member of Western Fibers, but I would like to see a spinoff or home building from the cellulose spray technology, the headquarters in Oklahoma, and then the gin, because there really are three different entities. The home building part, the machinery we need to make our like, so we can literally grow hemp in the field, let it dry standing, shut the water off, let it dry, cut it. We don't need it to rep for home building material on a whole plant, so I don't care. We can literally silage cut that into the particle sizes that we need, bring it right here to the plant so it never touches the ground, a human hand never touches it, put it right into our silo that feeds into our spray machine, and then mix our other products in with it. Never touches the ground. That's direct from the field.
And the fiber, you just keep the fiber attached so you're not needing to separate? Well, that's yep. much different than the spray, some of the other spray applications we've seen that need very little.
So this, maybe we can see it. Can you see it up close?
Yeah.
So this is kind of our spray. So this has cardboard in it, our hemp, you know, a lime slurry, a borate. It's a little different than traditional hempcrete. So traditional hempcrete, this is more of a traditional hempcrete block. So you can see the difference. You can see the difference. It's a, you know, this is a, it has more lime and binder in it than our stuff. So we don't need as much lime and binder in ours to get it to set. And then we put the lime plaster on the inside and the outside of the walls. And we can, so we do double stud walls. And so literally we can do a 9-inch thick wall, we can do a 12-inch, we can do a 16-inch. But when we do our double stud walls, it's open in between the two walls to your floor joists, and it's open into the attic space. So we have a monolithic spray that goes all the way around your house, all six sides, the floor, the ceiling, the walls, the, you know, everything is solid all the way through. So we have no thermal bridging. So when you talk about R values, you know, say, you know, fiberglass insulation, you know, you a 6-inch wall, you get, you know, an R30 out of it. We'll get that out of ours, but we don't have any thermal bridging. So it's really, R values are BS. And Mike loves to talk about what BSR values are, because they're not taking into consideration a room. You need to take into consideration the building, not just that piece of insulation between the studs, because on each side of the studs is a thermal bridge. Also, our homes are completely airtight. So we're going to pass a blower door test beyond belief. That's huge. So on the downside of that, if we don't put what's called like an ERV, and that's an exchange ventilation unit, you'll end up dying in our homes. You'll suffocate because they're so airtight, and that obviously would be an issue. So an ERV is a unit that pulls air from outside through a HEPA filter, passes over a radiator, and then into your home. Well, that radiator has the air from in your home coming through the radiator, exchanging the temperature inside your home, exchanging that temperature with the temperature of the air coming in. So here in the San Joaquin Valley, it was 117 degrees here for a few days this last year. You don't want to open your window and bring in 117 degree heat into your, you know, 72 degree home. So you run that through an ERV, and you can get that really close within, you know, 5 degrees or 5 or 10% of the exchange. Well, now your air conditioner works very lightly to keep that air conditioned. We talk about conditioning of air in a house. Everybody just thinks it's your thermostat, hot or cold. That's all you have to do. Humidity plays a huge part in comfort in your house. And of course, with the hempcrete wall and the lime, it'll absorb humidity typically during the night, in the evening. You know, you're running your dishwasher, you're taking a shower, you're breathing out all night, you're breathing out vapor. So your walls are absorbing that all night long. You know, when the sun hits it during the day, and now it starts to evaporate. The sun's starting to warm up the outside of that wall. It's pushing that vapor back out inside. And now your wall is cool to the touch inside because it's evaporating moisture. And we all know when you evaporate moisture, you put a cold towel, you know, wet towel, oh, it feels cold when you put it over your neck because it's evaporating moisture. That's, we sweat, we evaporate, we make stuff colder. So that's the same way your walls work in the summer. In the winter, it's the thermal mass. The thermal mass works in the summer too, but your thermal mass is like a big ship, very slow to turn. So your thermal mass retains that temperature of your house for a long time. So in a hemp home, say your power goes out and it's, you know, 30 degrees out, you're actually gonna have 2 to 3 days where that house is very slowly going to start coming down in temperature because of that thermal mass. That thermal mass will hold on to that heat and keep radiating it back in. So in a typical hemp home, you don't have to use but maybe 5 to 10% of the typical energy usage to keep your house cool or warm. And again, humidity plays a big role in that. And hemp homes naturally regulate humidity as well as retain heat or the cold. So it's every time we do something or we learn something, it's like, oh my God, this benefits this and this. It's like, you know, the truss plant. I wanted to get around not using plywood sheathing on the outside. Well, how do we make a wall strong enough? Well, you do a let-in brace. Well, those are illegal now in California. You can't do that anymore. That's where you just cut in a 1x6 diagonally into the wall so it can't break. But we can't do that anymore. So now we have to get an engineer to say, yes, a roof truss wall is stronger than a wall with plywood sheathing. So again, we need to prove that out. I was just on the phone yesterday with John Simonson up at OSU, Oregon State University, you know, where we had gone and checked out all of the great programs that they're doing. So we're actually sending up some samples for some R-value testing. We'll get our R-values back. So that's going to be really neat to have that documented. And then, you know, the goal is to build our first structure with our double stud wall. You know, we invented a cross brace to connect the two walls. We have a design patent that we're getting on the shape of the wall because we have a unique shape when we put it through our truss plant, which is really very... Again, it was just because I wanted it to be stronger. And then all of a sudden I realized, oh my God, that's a patentable design now. Yeah. So, you know, I don't really care about the patents. I want everything to be out there because everybody has to be doing what we're doing. Our goal is to build this factory, fine tune it, figure out how to get it to work. You know, CBD stocks are a great, you know, ramp to get us up to where we have to grow enough hemp to make it happen, but then replicate this all over the planet. Because if we can build carbon negative homes, mass produce them, we solve a job crisis, we solve a housing crisis, we solve a farming crisis. We don't need your herbicides or pesticides. Farmers don't have to spray toxic chemicals. We're going to clean the soil. We're going to aerate the soil. We're going to give them a healthy rotational crop to plant that has, you do nothing to a hemp crop while it's growing. Sit there and listen to it grow. And that's it. There's nothing to do. Water it, period. And if you're in a place you get water, you don't have to do anything. So again, it's everything is a win all the way down the line. I keep expecting somewhere there's going to be a drawback or something. Oh man. And really all it is we don't have the industry to buy the fiber to make all of this waste product into everything else that we need. Because the fiber should be.
You're referring to the herd.
Yes.
And reality is, right, there's a lot of market that herd can feed into. We can't discredit.
The fiber is more expensive. The fiber has a higher value. So in a plant, yeah, it's a lower value. It's, to me, more useful. Yes. But you get so much more of it. So,
it has an immediate market at least, right? Especially while the fiber market is developing. Because it will. You know, there's a lot of technology that needs to come to the United States on scale. You know, we talk about that secondary and third, you know, additional processing outside of decortication. But
yeah, no, it's like I said, we're wide open. This industry is ready to explode. We just need our government and some private sector to really understand it and get involved. And shows like this, you know, this is education. This is the only way it's going to happen. Nobody knows, you know, I mean, there's probably a handful of us that have the amount of knowledge that, you know, maybe 10 or 12 of us in this country have with such a you know, 20,000 foot view of everything. Mm-hmm. You know, you get to talk to experts all over the place in the industry. Mm-hmm. It's just like, you know, our friend Dave Cooper. Mm-hmm. I have learned so much. I've probably watched 300 of his episodes. Mm-hmm. I've got to listen to 300 CEOs of modular companies all over the world and go inside and look at their companies through modern technology, social media. And you could never do that. There's no way. It would take a lifetime. I mean, look at Dave. He travels all the time.
Yeah. You know? So for those of you that don't know Dave Cooper, Dave does something similar to what I do, but specific to offsite and modular building, really with the intention of opening up opportunity for change within the construction industry and building industry. And he has interviewed hundreds of people, him and his wife, Jennifer. They travel all over, like you said, Wade, in different facilities, and they've got some incredible partners that are very interested in more sustainable building solutions. And so they come to the table all the time. I know that there's a few others within our industry that have been interviewed by him and have been on the show. And so shout out, but he is all over LinkedIn. Look him up, Dave Cooper Live. He travels also to all of the big building and construction shows and does the same thing, interviews multiple people. It's he's very, very connected in that space and has done a good job.
You and I both have had great interviews with him.
Yep.
Go check out both of our shows on DaveCooper.live, as his kids know him as.
There you go. That's awesome. Awesome. So, anything else you want to add? We're almost out of time, and this goes fast every time we get on here. But
I know it's amazing. So I used to have a talk show. I had a radio show when I lived in Santa Cruz Mountains there called Wade's World of Cannabis. And I was in the cannabis and CBD industry, and immediately within about a month of the show, it just converged totally into hemp and hemp building materials and everything. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to do it again. I just thank you for doing what you're doing, because again, if people don't hear stuff and understand stuff and get to know stuff, I mean, who knew that 1 ton of hemp could hold 2.5 tons of CO2? How do you wrap your mind around that? Well, you have to explain it. It's the C in carbon with the O2 of air that goes back into the atmosphere. But, you know, a stalk of hemp is basically, you know, almost 60% carbon. And carbon's everything. So, you know, making biochar out of hemp is an incredible product because of the porosity of hemp. The tiny little micro veins in hemp, when they crystallize in the biochar, it preserves the shape. And now you have a huge surface area. So like, you know, 1 gram of biochar from hemp, if you were to measure the surface area, it's the size of our barn or a football field. And that's why it's great for, you know, hemp batteries, great for filters, great for air filters. You know, we use it in your fish tanks, that charcoal, that's biochar basically. Granular activated filters for water, that's, you know, it's carbon, has a big surface area. Pulls it out. If you inoculate it with like worm castings and microbes and you put it in the soil, it's like a penthouse condominium for microbes to live in. And now our roots can access that mycorrhizal zone and get all the nutrients that they need. It's just, there's so much. Again, it just, everything leads to something that's even better and more amazing. And I don't know of anything on the planet like it. You know, hemp absorbs roughly 2 times more CO2 in its lifetime than any other plant. And of course, we know we can plant it harvest every 90, 120, 140 days. So, you know, here in the valley, we can be growing easily 3 crops a year, no problem.
Well, and like you had mentioned before, the value of it with the rotation, right? Yeah. We want to get away from the monocropping, but really that value for adding it in and its capability to improve multiple aspects, facets, yes.
And totally so for us to succeed here at Western Fibers, I mean, if somebody just said, you know, call me up. Hey man, I want to order your first home. I'll buy it. You know, what is it? 25, 30 grand. Let's get that first one built. And I'm sure we can do the first one for 25 or 30 grand, a 10 by 12. You don't need a permit for it, but that's really where we're at right now. We need somebody to step up. With, you know, literally 25 to 30 grand would get us our first model built, a proof of concept. And then we need about a 50 grand a month burn rate for operating the factory to get it going. And we only need like probably $1 million line of credit, and we're off to the races. Like I said, by the time we put our 6th, 7th, maybe 8th home on those lots that we own, we're in the black, and then we're just running.
Okay, so if somebody's looking to connect with you, there's a connect with us or contact us page on the website, right? Yep. Western Fibers with an S.
Yes.
I'll share that page again right now so you guys have it. And then
there was
another question just now asking about the ideal genetics for hemp construction. And you guys use the Hane variety, right? The Chinese varieties. But you also said that using any other of the cannabis stock works just fine as well. It's really the cellulose content you're looking for.
So for building materials, doesn't matter. Any type of hemp. I don't care if it's 2-foot-tall hemp that, you know, you just couldn't get to grow for whatever reason. We can chop that up and use it the same as a 25-foot-tall hemp. Now, when you're talking fiber, obviously you want long, unbroken, no branches to get that long fiber. But that's the fiber industry. And again, we don't really have a fiber industry here in this country. So for us, you know, we can grind.
We've got a small fiber.
Yeah, that's right. When 1% of our clothing is made here in America, we don't have a fiber industry.
Well, we do. And I'm going to throw this out there real, just really quick, because I agree it's very small, especially compared to what we're seeing on the herd production. And a lot of our processors are really right now, you know, leaning into the sale of herd and the market that's available currently for herd. So I do support that. But Patagonia has collaborated and done some awesome things for our Global Hemp Association farmers. So if you're a farming member of Global Hemp Association, please reach out to me. We are going to be sending an email out shortly, but Patagonia is offering to basically give back a thank you by offering some of their workwear that is a hemp workwear. Hemp is a major line in their major product in their workwear line. And so they're counting on the industry growing and they're here to support it. And so to say thank you to our farmers for your hard work and to kind of give perspective that we are seeing fiber moving into the industry and into the market. We want to make sure that we take care of you guys and say thank you. So reach out to me if you are farming hemp this year and if I can help support you and connect you and get you some hemp workwear. I'd love your perspective and feedback, because everything we've seen as far as LCAs and, you know, wearability, hemp wins. And so I'd love to support that. Well, Wade, thank you so much for your time. Thank you, everybody else who's listened today. We've had tons of comments. Wade, go over to the YouTube channel or our LinkedIn and check out the video, because you will be able to see all of the comments and get any feedback. There's a couple of people who have said, hey, send me over some information about the investment. They feel like they can help get funding to go through. So check that out. And then again, anybody else that has questions, don't hesitate. I'd love to have you to join or support Global Hemp Association. We've got a huge resource library on our member portal with both, you know, like LCAs, research, data, as well as a directory, so that it helps you guys stay connected and build those relationships. So thank you very much for your support again, and we'll see you next time, Wade.
Thank you.
Thank you. See you later. Yeah.